We have to be who we are, and we have to not try to compare ourselves to people. It is a ticket for failure to want to be somebody other than who we are. And so we have to stay within our lanes and develop that lane versus trying to be somebody else and compare ourselves. It's very fruitless to go that way.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Cheerological. All businesses make a promise. And to the extent that we keep those promises, we have the opportunity to continue with our business. To the extent that we exceed those promises, we not only get to continue with our business, it probably thrives as well. Many of us have the kinds of practices we do because of the broken promises of conventional medicine. The pill that failed to deliver its primetime promise, the procedure that didn't help. In fact, now life is more difficult. And the promise that vested interest-funded research would alleviate the uncertainty that comes with most medical treatment. But how many of those so-called evidence-based insurance-funded procedures have worked for the patients that arrived in your office? I suspect enough didn't to help you make a tidy living. Conventional medicine promises certainty. And when I look at my practice and the way I've talked to people over the years, I too have attempted to cozy up to the deep need we have for certainty. But as time has gone on, I've come to realize that the work we do, and really, the work our colleagues do with their forms of medicine as well, we all do the best we can with what we got. But often enough, there's just not much certainty in our kind of work. That's partly why medical professionals have patients sign a consent to treat. And on that, we list out all the ways that things might go wrong. We do what we can to minimize uncertainty. We all feel better that way. And I'm wondering if there might be a way to speak to the uncertain nature of medicine, the uncertain nature of life and how this world unfolds and invite it in, to let uncertainty have a voice in our work. What if this cancer treatment doesn't work? What if this pain that threatens the way you work is actually a partner for life? What if the black hole of despair isn't medicatable? Those monsters we had under the bed when we were 8 years old, I suspect they're still with us, but we don't talk about them like we did when we were 8 years old. Uncertainty isn't comfortable. We shore up our lives against it with insurance policies, emergency cash funds, good diets, proper exercise, lucky charms, and perhaps a modicum of denial. Uncertainty is a great way to sell a product or service that promises to eliminate or at least minimize it. You might promise certainty in your work. It no doubt will draw people to you. But do keep in mind that you're making a promise here. And in the long term, businesses that keep their promises, they tend to have more longevity. And there's a congruence that arises when we embrace the uncertainty that something might not work. And it tends to lead to greater integrity, more trust, and perhaps even better outcomes in the face of uncertainty when we pay more attention to it. I've got a question for you. Be honest here. Notice what's the first word that pops into your mind when I say wood organ. Did you say liver? If you're like most practitioners, you probably did. In our training, most of us have acquired the bias that the yin organs are more important than the yang organs. So for example, if you're thinking about, air quotes here, treating dampness, you probably would be sure to include some points on the spleen meridian, and perhaps on the kidney as well. But dampness is best treated by boosting up the dryness in the body, and the yangming is the driest of the six jing. And of the two yangming organs in the body, the metal yangming is about as dry as you can get. So the next time you're looking to deal with issues of dampness, consider leaving the spleen alone, but tonify the large intestine to boost up the parching influence of the yangming metal. Since studying the SAM system for the past year, I've found that whenever there is some dampness that needs drying, the large intestine is often a really good place to start. If you're an herbalist, you'll already know that a lot of the, again, air quotes here, spleen tonic formulas, they contain a not small amount of herbs that dry and drain fluids. Really, what we're looking at here is using the body's proper physiology to address areas where the physiology is a bit out of whack. We are going to be talking about this and a lot more at the Introduction to Sa'am Acupuncture here in St. Louis on June 29th and 30th. This class will be live streamed, so if you can't join us in person, then stream the class to your living room or wherever you happen to be. The replay of the live stream will be available for 2 weeks after the event. So if you've been wanting to learn more about this method, but you can't join us in person, then take advantage of us beaming the class to you. Details, of course, on the website, or go to chiological.com/Sa'am-class. And speaking of learning, Lhasa OMS is dedicated not just to bringing you quality supplies at fair prices. They also know that a successful practice requires lifelong learning, and so not only support Chiological, but also regularly run their own webinars and offer other learning opportunities. Next time you're on their website buying pins or other clinical supplies, check out the list of webinar replays they have. The sessions from the February Love Your Practice Summit are up there now, and there's some great stuff if you're still working out your marketing thing. Also, in addition to supporting our profession with resources for learning, Lhasa OMS also works with state organizations to help protect and promote the practice of acupuncture. Sign up for their mailing list, as they've got these great flash specials on all the supplies that you regularly use in your practice. In today's conversation, we're discussing confidence. Yeah, that elusive feeling that lets us feel good about ourselves when we're trying to help people and we're not sure if we have what it takes to help. Our self-image and our self-talk can really assist or hinder in the practice of medicine, and sometimes leaving us wondering if we might be better off being a barista or a bartender or maybe going back to school for more initials after our name. Putting ourselves squarely in front of uncertainty and working so intimately with the general public, it's no easy thing. It requires some cultivation and it requires some fortitude. Let's get into it. Dennis Von Elg, welcome to Chiological.
Thanks, Michael. Super happy to be here.
Yeah, we had some conversation a while back. We were talking on the phone. Man, we were gabbing for a while. I wish I'd been rolling tape back then. And what we were talking about, I mean, you've been a longtime teacher of Chinese medicine. We're going to get into that in a moment. And what we were talking about was how students, and especially how new practitioners, go through that journey of acquiring some confidence in what they do and just how essential that is. And that it's not really something that you can teach in schools, but it's like a, you know, a path that you can go down and then life can kind of, you know, give you the lessons that you need. What I'd like to begin with this is what originally brought you into doing Chinese medicine and then what got you involved in teaching?
Yeah, those are great questions. And everybody has their stories, and I certainly have mine. I was always interested in Asian culture and Asian arts. And the first thing that got me was I had an unfortunate incident where I was placing my bicycle on a bike rack on the back of a car using a bungee cord. And the bungee cord slipped off and smashed me in the eye. And I felt like I got hit by Muhammad Ali. Knocked me out cold. I was left with, a concussion and an eyeball filled with blood. Sorry to get graphic right from the start here. But the headaches were so brutal and the vision was so battered that I couldn't go to a job I had in the mountains that summer. At least I was told that by my doctors. And I went and I saw Michael Tierra down in Santa Cruz. And they were telling me I was down for 2 weeks, maybe a month. And due to the treatments that him and his wife gave me, I left for the mountains about 5 days later and able to do the work that I did in the mountains. So that was pretty striking, literally.
That catches your attention, doesn't it? Oh, hey, by the way, it's impossible. You're not going to the mountains. And 5 days later, you're in the mountains.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it was my, you know, everybody looks forward to their summer work when you're young. And that was my job. And I was thrilled to be able to do that. And then the next time I had acupuncture, this was really striking too. I was in the mountains and backpacking and my back went out and I couldn't backpack out of the mountains. And there was a guy there who was an acupuncturist and he had needles and he did a couple of treatments over 2 days. And the next, that day I put on my backpack and walked out of the mountains. So, you know, you have those kinds of experiences. They stick with you, of course. And then that led me down a path of I'd always wanted to kind of work with living things. I have a degree in horticulture, and working with people was part of something that I certainly enjoyed. And then how I became a teacher, again, came out of a mishap. I got in a bad car accident and I...
Boy, your mishaps are really fortunate, aren't they?
I look forward to them at this point, Michael. Yeah. So my car was in the shop and I had to take a bus home from Oakland to Berkeley. But my last patient of the day happened to live about six blocks from my home. And she offered a ride home to Berkeley for me. And I said, sure, thank you. And she said, can I take you home? I said, no, just drop me off by your house or near your house and I'll just walk home. It was a gorgeous summer afternoon. And as I was walking home, right between her home and my home, I saw a building that said the Acupuncture and Integrative Medicine College. And I thought, wow, when did that go in there? And so I walked over there and went to go walk in, and the door was locked. So I shook it a couple times and then walked away. And then as I was walking away, the door opened up and a head poked out and said, can I help you? And I said, oh, no, it's okay. I'm just an acupuncturist, and I just was sort of curious as to this new school here. And it was Dr. Ota, who was the president of formerly Meiji, now AIMC, and he was very gracious, and he invited me in, and we had a little chat, and about an hour later, I walked out with a job. So
wow,
it was rather serendipitous, and then I've been stuck there since 2002, and still love teaching as if it was the first day.
Wow.
Yeah.
It is curious that these, and I love the word that you use, mishap, that these mishaps, these things that at the moment it's like, oh, here's an inconvenience, or here's a problem, or here's this thing that's gone astray. And it turns out if it wasn't for that, oh my God, the life that we have would have never opened up.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically the story I look at it as sort of the story of yin and yang, in that yin presents as a type of chaos, and from that, this yang direction forms. It's the pivot of so much that happens in our lives. We have to go through some kind of chaos, and by the same token, is that if we are too ordered in our life and too stiff in our life and unwilling to make changes, eventually that chaos is going to hit. It's going to all explode on us, right?
Well, you know, and it seems that sometimes we need something that will soften us up a bit so that we're actually kind of malleable enough to be changed.
Correct. And I think that that's where we walk the path between yin and yang, is by keeping it soft and keeping it directed and keeping us fluid. And that fluidity is what allows us to adapt. Without that that fluidity, we as humans become extraordinarily vulnerable. And that's where our work really is direction as well as fluidity. And that's the bamboo that has a direction, yet is able to bend in the face of storms and extreme conditions.
So I want to swing us back to confidence and practice. You know, it's it's something that it seems a lot of colleagues talk about, especially people that are just starting out, right? Because, well, let me just tell you a little story here. I did my training in Seattle. Back in those days, there were three acupuncture schools in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Now there's just two, but back then there were three. And at the end of my third year, I had a pretty good sized house back then because I used to work in IT. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just making a transition into this whole other world. And I had a party and invited everyone from all the three schools, you know, so that people could kind of meet each other and mingle. And, you know, this is my community, right? And I was in my third year. I'm about to graduate. There were a number of other people about to graduate. I remember having a conversation with a woman who said, I can't wait to go. I am so ready. I got it down. I'm ready to do this stuff. And I paused for a moment and I thought, oh man, I am not sure that I've got what I need. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do this. I've been exposed to a lot of great stuff. It's super interesting, but I've got this feeling in my gut. One of us is wrong at this moment, because she had like, yep, I got it. I understand this. And I was thinking maybe in 10 years, I'm going to understand this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we can inhabit a really wide range of a sense of confidence. Yeah. And I remember at that time thinking, and this was so clear to me, it's like one of us is wrong. It's like maybe you're overconfident, or maybe I'm, you know, really not up to the task of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so this thing about confidence, I think it has a lot to do with our personalities and maybe our past life experience. And there's just so many facets to it. I'd love to get your take. I mean, you've watched students for decades now go from not knowing anything to, you know, becoming practitioners. Is there any kind of a path that you see that people tend to take with learning confidence, or is it very individualized? Love to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I've been thinking about that a lot because I do keep in touch with a lot of my former students, and I love watching them take the various paths that they take. I think that the biggest asset that they all share, the ones that do well, is they have a thick skin and they're willing to be scared as hell. So many of us come from a variety of different experiences, occupations, cultures, our stories with our relationships and the people in our lives. People have conquered great hurdles to get to the point where they get to have that LAC behind their name, or they're being a licensed acupuncturist, and there's a lot of sacrifice that goes on in there. You know, it has nothing to do with intelligence. It has everything to do with being able to shake off the things that we initially maybe call a failure, but it's really is that learning lesson. I've seen some people who they are in practice for many years, and then finally one day they kind of say, you know, I need a shift, and they're willing to extend themselves very readily, and they have a vision. And they, cultivate that vision. They definitely see themselves in that role. And when they don't, they're willing to just sort of jump anyway. You know, when I first started practicing, I met somebody who was telling me that her father had started 14 businesses in his life, of which 8 of them failed miserably, and 6 of them he was able to sell at a tremendous profit.
And wow, 6 of 8?
Yeah, which
that is
pretty great, right?
That is a spanking great entrepreneur, because usually it's 20%.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, being an entrepreneur is a terrible way to make money.
Right.
Right. Most of them fail.
Yeah, but he had a resilience that was so impressive, and I've always held that thought in my mind when I've struggled and when things didn't go the right way. And you know, I also coach baseball. And so I have to teach resilience to my kids. You know, a baseball player, a hitter fails, 70% of the time. And it's important for them to walk away from the home plate after striking out with their chin up. You have to be able to have that short memory that says, I'm going to go back in there and get in the batter's box again. So I see that with my students. And I think that's probably the greatest asset that they can have. Now, all of us are in this field because we want to be helpful, that we want to try to decrease people's suffering. And that has to be kind of in the forefront of I think, our thinking. That's what keeps us moving forward. And with every person that we help, we have to hold that up as a, I don't want to say it's a trophy, but it's something that says this is why we're doing it. And when the people that don't get better, again, we have to have a short memory, and we don't really know entirely. It's very difficult to be conclusive as to why they didn't get better or why things didn't turn out the way we wanted them to. So we have to keep our eyes on the prize. And that's what I do all the time. After 19 years of practicing, I've had plenty of situations where patients didn't get the outcomes that I wanted them to. And I keep sharing those stories with my students. I share those stories more than I do my successes. Absolutely. And to let them know that we are humans dealing in a very sophisticated healing art. And, healing comes from a lot of different ways. And so that plays into another thing, which is the gifts that we all have, because we are heart-centered people. And if we acknowledge that and we work from our heart, we can touch a lot of lives very deeply. And that's something that I think is something I try to cultivate with my students. Look them in the eyes, you know, the eyes being the window to the shen. Look them in the eyes and let them see your eyes as from your heart. And I think that is something that gives us opportunities to make that deep-seated connection between the chi and the essence, and gives us opportunities to really come out of the starting blocks with a lot of vitality.
Absolutely. I'm thinking here of a patient that I've got. This is not every patient, right? I mean, some people, you can't help them and they go, yeah, that didn't work, and they're gone. But sometimes you do make these connections with people. And I'm thinking of one patient in particular that I've got, who sticks with me. And I have to tell you, I have actually taken her off the rails more than put her on them. And we've had the conversation about, look, I'm doing the best I can, and I know it's been really up and down, and actually more downs than ups. And, you know, when that kind of thing happens, I'm always looking, let's find someone else for you that might be able to help. And I had that conversation, and she says, look, I've been to all kinds of other places, and I understand that what I've got going on is not simple. And yes, it's been up and down here, but regardless of it's up or down, you seem to still be with me.
Yeah.
And so Let's stick with this and find out if we can figure out what's going on.
Yeah, fantastic.
I don't think we get lots of patients like that, right? The promise of medicine is we're going to fix this. And, you know, acupuncture and Chinese medicine, because people don't particularly understand it and they've heard amazing stories, they often think it's going to be magic and, you know, one or two, maybe three treatments and, you know, the world is completely different. And that sometimes happens, but sometimes it's the exact opposite, like the patient I just talked about. And this thing that you mentioned about being connected in that way, being like really open-hearted and very transparent, sometimes that will give people something to hold on to as we go through it, because they're actually accompanied in the process. Maybe for the first time, they're being accompanied instead of having something done to them.
Right. And that kind of care, I think it trumps the kind of the inner critic that we all have, that's telling us that we don't know our formulas well enough. We don't know our points, and perhaps our diagnosis is way off. And I don't ever want to dismiss the importance of those things. We are TCM practitioners.
Because we do make mistakes.
Because we do make mistakes. Absolutely.
We do make mistakes.
Yeah. So that voice that comes in all the time is one that I think we have to acknowledge, and we have to be aware of it, and we have to bear witness to that voice and what it's saying. But we also, again, have to be able to understand that we are all learning. You know, I was gifted with some incredible mentors, which I want to talk about actually a little bit about that. In that, our mentors who've been practicing for, you know, decades, perhaps more than we have, you know, make these mistakes, and they somehow find a way to persevere, or they miss things, or they're just flat out not getting the results they want to. We have to be who we are, and we have to not try to compare ourselves to other people. It is a ticket for failure to want to be somebody other than who we are. And so we have to stay within our lanes and develop that lane versus trying to be somebody else and compare ourselves. It's very fruitless to go that way. So the inner critic is a tough one. As I said, I had great mentors, and I think that's actually something that is really missing in our medicine, that when we get cast off into the cold, cold world as brand new acupuncturists expecting to hang our shingle and heal our communities, if we do it all by ourselves, that's a tough path to walk. And I was so incredibly lucky. When I first started practicing, I was gifted a connection to an acupuncturist who had been practicing for about 15 years. And she was looking for somebody to help her out in her practice. And she asked me to give her a treatment. Of course, I just broke out into a sweat. And I thought, oh my gosh, she wants me to treat her, right? You know?
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And she looked at me very kindly and she said, all I want you to do is put in four gates in Yin Tang. And at that moment, I just calmed me down and I put in the four gates of Yin Tang. And she said, you did that, you know, perfectly. That was wonderful. And I think those are the baby steps that give us, that she set me up for success. And that's what I try to do with my students, is set my students up with success. And then when the time is ripe, then we try to, you know, set somebody up for a small failure so that we can learn, or set somebody up to be challenged in a way that might be overextended. And from that experience, where from putting in four gates in Yin Tang, you know, I started to work with other things. And later on, as I was working with my mentors, one of them said to me a few years into it, she said, you know, Dennis, you're always scratching for something else and for something new and for something different. And what I want to say to you, she said, I want you to look in my eyes. She said, you've arrived. You're here. You where you wanted to be. You're exactly where you wanted to be. And so enjoy this particular place in your life and the next one. And it made sense. And so a lot of times when I'm getting ahead of myself or I'm attaching myself to something that maybe didn't go as well as I wanted to from the past, I have to just keep reminding me that I've arrived. I'm here. And I'm helping people. And the next person that comes in my door, my intention, my shen, my whole energy is going to be towards trying to help that person. And that's what Thrival is. I've had very wonderful, kind people, from Robert Levine in Berkeley to Nancy Noctway and Abigail Saraski, and some incredible people that were very gentle and at the same time very blunt at times to help me get better.
Yes, and we need both.
We do. Yeah.
We really need both. And I'm struck. I mean, it just rings a chord, you know, sound of truth in me when you say that we need mentors.
Mm-hmm.
Because I look back on the path that I have followed. And if it was not for people that were willing to meet me where I was, take me along, give me those challenges that you were talking about with tremendous kindness and generosity, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do it either. I don't think any of us make it on our own. I really do feel like there's a community that helps to support us in this.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, that just really sounds right. I mean, it makes me wonder about what else we can do as a community of practitioners to help people, you know, postgraduate, make those forays into, number one, recognizing that there's something you got, you don't have to worry about that anymore. And number two, there's some blind spots and let's open your eyes up to those.
Right. I think that we are all, whether we want to be or not, we are all ambassadors of our medicine. And if TCM is to thrive, if this incredible medicine is to thrive in our culture, we have to form some type of links to each other so that we can benefit each other and the medicine. And I've run into people who have been very protective of their medicine. They don't want to share what they know, like as if there's some kind of secrets only to be practiced by, you know, heads of state or something. And it really breaks my heart when I hear that and when I see that.
Well, there's that thing about business and competition too. You know, if that joker down the street knows what I know, some of my patients might go there. You know, especially in saturated markets, there is some of that going on. People are afraid for their livelihood. People are afraid they don't have enough. And, you know, our colleagues and support are seen many times not as support, but as a threat.
Right. And I'm just somebody, my philosophy feels that that's a sad way to live. It's a sad way to practice because this is the people's medicine. This medicine came from all the books being open, and there were some situations where that wasn't necessarily true. But I just feel that kind of fear. It's not about protecting this population labeled X as the only resource. It's about spreading it out so X becomes Y, and everything else. We get to embrace a larger population of people because the medicine is helpful. We know it's helpful. We know it works. So by sharing the medicine and having more people benefit, then word of mouth and the reputation of our medicine begins to grow. That's the success. That's a very compromised sense of success if we're just trying to help our patients and not let our other people help their patients. I feel strongly about that. So my medicine is a complete open book to everybody. I try to help as many students as I possibly can, even the students that are sometimes difficult. Sometimes maybe not the easiest people to communicate with. They're going to go out in the world. They're going to be ambassadors of our medicine. They're going to be helping people. And I want them to succeed. Absolutely. Anything short of that is a pretty significant compromise.
Yeah. I love your perspective that we're also ambassadors in the medicine, and that we want, overall in the culture, that people, when they think about acupuncture, when they think about East Asian medicine, they go, oh yeah, that cool, amazing stuff.
Yeah.
Instead of, oh, that didn't work. I sometimes have people call, and they ask about, my big bugaboo these days is the non-smoking thing, right? Do you do that auricular acupuncture to stop smoking? And my question is always, well, do you want to stop smoking?
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, of course I want to stop smoking. Do you want to stop smoking, or do you want the acupuncture to make you stop smoking? And when I ask it that way, they're like, oh, well, I guess I want the acupuncture to make me stop smoking. And I'm real straight up with these folks. I say, don't waste your time and don't waste your money. And be really leery of anyone who says that they can make you stop smoking with it. And the reason that I do that, and it just might be my really lousy skills with making people stop smoking. I don't think you can make anybody do anything. But I say that because I don't want people saying, well, I tried that acupuncture once and you know what? It didn't work. I'd rather that people had, a sense of what the potentials truly are. And so that they can come away from it with a sense of, yes, that was helpful. And then they say, acupuncture, yes, that was really helpful. I walked out with a backpack from the woods because of acupuncture.
Right. Yeah. And that's, every patient that comes in for a treatment is going to be either an advocate of our medicine, or they're going to have something that compromises that. That's, they go out in the world trumpeting their experiences. And that they're at dinner parties, they're in the workplace, they're out there talking about our medicine. And so we have to take responsibility for that by I think trying to help as many people as we can and being, again, good representatives of our medicine. That's what it means to be a professional.
I really appreciate your perspective of helping all of us along so that people in our culture are better served, and so that our medicine is better served. We all get better if we're all getting better.
Exactly. It's. I mean, I think it's a fundamental truth as Ted Kaptchuk's book, the web that has no weaver. We are a web. We are in this thing together. How many of us have been approached by somebody at some point that said, "Yeah, there was this acupuncturist who," and then they fill in the blank for something awful that happened, or something that they did, or something, whether it's a wrong herbal prescription or a damaging one. And now they'll never take Chinese herbs, or acupuncture did this and it didn't help me at all. And we all have to deal with that. So I think we all are responsible to our medicine. We take that oath at graduations to be professionals and to be present all the time in the best way we can for the medicine as a whole. So that's kind of a piece that I find. But I wanted to give kind of back to the piece about our confidence. And one thing that I used to do, and I don't do it as much anymore, and I should, which is, I remember one of my teachers many years ago, she would oftentimes light a candle just to take a moment to call in the ancestors of our medicine. And I teach my students, when particularly in the areas of pulse reading, that we are totally connected to that through our studies and through our spirit. And by calling in the ancestors, we can gain a lot of strength by basically allowing that energetics to flow into our clinic. And when we're like feeling a pulse, Wang Shuhe and Li Shijun and so on, these doctors felt things that, and they named them, through their clinical practice and over hundreds of years, they were able to figure out what they meant. But I don't think that it's that stops there. And I try to encourage my students to name pulses in any way they feel is appropriate for them to gain insight into what's happening. So I tell them, if you want to call that pulse the bunny rabbit pulse, call it the bunny rabbit pulse. If you want to call it the hopping frog, or I don't care. What you're trying to find is the characteristics get intimately sensitive to what is happening here. Yes, the Wang Shuhe system is helpful, extremely helpful, and it's going to guide your pulse reading. So, and the Li Shijun system is going to, and other great pulse readers like Leon Hammer and John Shen, etc. But ultimately, you have to be able to interpret that to what it is and make sense of it. Pulse reading is something that is very daunting for our patients or for our students. They oftentimes give up on it. I've talked to many students who just don't do pulses anymore because they feel like it just doesn't help them anymore because they can't make sense of it. And I like students to return to that form, to come back to that and give it another try and see what they're feeling. And I try to simplify it as much as I can for them. If it just means you're going to get the heart rate relative to the respiratory rate, then so be that. Just do that. If you're just going to go
from... Yes, enter it where you can.
Right. Yeah. And if you're just going to go from shallow to deep or from tense to soft, then so be it. Just pick up on that. And again, it goes back to the baby steps that help you move along. And so at this point, I'm teaching a lot of students just to feel for stagnation. I feel like and everybody can relate to this, that we've all had issues in our life that didn't go well. Sometimes they were very violent and traumatic and in a moment's notice. Sometimes they were over a period of time where we were where the trauma penetrated very deeply, and now it's sequestered away somewhere in the viscera. And so a lot of times we can find that, and we can find congestion pretty easily in the pulses. It just takes a little bit of time and sensitivity and patience, and we can find that congestion, and just teaching them to find that congestion and free it. Because until we free that congestion, it's very difficult to get the results that we're looking for. It doesn't matter what the patient has got in going on in their body. It doesn't matter if it's a sprained ankle that won't get better or lung cancer. So looking for congestion is something that's very accessible to our patients or for our students, and it's something that our medicine treats extremely readily.
It really does. And that stuff sticks around in the pulse.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It really, mm-hmm. I'm thinking there's a patient I've got. I love that you talk about naming pulses with your own, with your own names. I've been doing this for a number of years now on my own. There's a couple pulses I've come across and I'll feel it. And I remember the first few times I felt it, I was like, what the heck is that? All right. That I haven't felt anything like that before. What's the name for that pulse? It's like, it's the ringing pulse. All right. There's a pulse I feel. It's usually in the Sun position and it rings. It's like you got your fingers on a ringing bell. And for the longest time, I'd be like, oh, there's that ringing pulse. What the hell is that thing? I try to make sense of it. Maybe it means this, and I treat a certain way. Nope, still there. Maybe it means that, Nope, still there. This is one of these things. I'm still figuring out exactly what it means. But I do know this. When I feel it, I know it's there. I know I need to be really attentive. And it tends to be something that is not so easy to resolve. It's something deep-seated. And so when I feel that, I know there's something deep-seated and I need to figure out, like you were saying, sometimes something goes way deep in the body. It's a sign there's something that might be blocking. And until we resolve that, there's only so far we can go with the rest of the treatments.
Yeah. Absolutely. I had a patient this last couple of weeks, a woman who came in, and she's been in a tremendous pain for 10 years. She's got hip pain, knee pain, back pain, a lot of the stuff that we would consider kidney damage, kidney deficiency, kidney imbalance. And as I started working with her pulses, I could feel something that was very, very tense and knotted in the right chair position. And it clearly wasn't associated with the Mingmen. It was something different. And so I attached it to the pericardium, which we oftentimes do in that position. Mm-hmm. And simply worked the pericardium, worked the Jueyin, combined it with the Xiaoyang because it's the place of pivot, and softened that up. And it was most incredible second visit I've had in a little while, where she walked in and I said, how were your last few days? And I have her booked for 2 times a week for the next 4 weeks. And she came back and said, well, it was quite interesting. And I said, well, what happened? She said, well, I don't know if I told you this, but I live with my husband and my adult son. And I haven't felt connected to either one of them for quite a long time. My son just goes to college, and then he comes home and he plays video games and studies. And he doesn't come out hardly at all. He eats his meals in his bedroom. And my husband is just seemingly getting older and disinterested in my experience. And neither one of them validate my pain at all. And they kind of roll their eyes at it, so to speak. And it's kind of a heartbreaking story. And she said, so when I left your office, the pain felt like it had decreased about 40%, but then it came raging back the next day. And it was really bad. And we've all seen this happen, right? Where you start rocking that boulder, it starts to move and things can go in a lot of different directions. And so she said that the pain was so bad that she started getting angry. And she confronted her son and her husband at lunch and just spelled out what her experiences is, how much pain she was in, and how frustrated she was that neither one of them were willing to respond. In fact, I think she said that she had asked for one of them to get a bowl off of the top shelf, and they kind of were hesitant and frustrated with her. And so she spelled it out. She said she spoke uninterrupted for about 15 minutes to them. And at the end of the conversation, her son said, Mom, I had no idea how much pain you were in. I wish you would have told us. He said, I saw that you weren't comfortable, and I heard you kind of complain, but you never really said it to us. And the dad echoed the same sentiment. And they totally got it. They totally understood. They totally were willing to support her once she was able to articulate her experience. And as you would expect, lo and behold, she said she woke up the next day for the first time in 10 years pain-free, totally pain-free. And it kind of crept in again later on in the day, but her pain, she said, had dropped down about 70% over the 24 or 36 hours before she came and walked in, since she had had this conversation with her family.
Reconnected through the pericardium.
Reconnected through the pericardium. And it was so striking. And we all love these stories. And this is a story I'm telling here, but I could tell 5 other stories that went a different direction. It's about being able to find where that congestion is. And at this point in my practice, yeah, I can name it an organ. I do go the pulses to the organ level, and I do find the weakest organ, and I try to tonify that organ. Most of us are familiar with creating a treatment that'll strengthen the weakest organ system to have long-term benefits for our patients as we look towards the future. But it's that congestion that I've learned at this point in my practice, that if I don't get to that, it's difficult to get anything to stick. And so that's kind of where I sit. And I think that's easy. I think it's accessible to new practitioners if they just want to sit there and take the time. You know, oftentimes that congestion is in the heart. We have a lot of situations, a lot of pathologies in our culture due to us being basically the liver people, the wood people, where that wood element energy moves along the generation into the fire and moves into the heart of the pericardium, and it congests there. A lot of times it's heat, but it can be other types of congestion as well. We're familiar with that quite well. But we see a lot of congestion that happens right at the diaphragm. We see that area of the body where we don't breathe. And that lack of breath, that lack of taking a full breath or lack of cardiovascular exercise or lack of experiencing and expressing ourselves in our fullest will create a lot of congestion in the diaphragm. And by releasing the diaphragm, we can get our patients to open up and move qi readily between the middle burner and the upper burner. We see a lot of congestion.
It can make such a huge difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
It can make such a... I recently learned something from a friend of mine. He's got this thing, after he puts some needles in, he'll ask people to take a deep breath into their lower abdomen. He'll actually put his hand very gently so they have a physical cue as to where to breathe. And I thought that looks kind of cool. I just started doing it in my clinic. And what I've discovered is, because originally I thought, it's nice, we'll get him to settle on the table. But what I've discovered is it's super diagnostic, because if I gently put my hand on their lower abdomen and ask them to breathe so that their breath raises up my hand, if they can do it, then okay, that system's pretty clear. That's good. I have had people, their breath doesn't get much below REN 17. And I wouldn't have known that had I not been attending in that way. And you can really tell how far is that breath, how far is that qi moving down from the upper into the middle, down into the lower jowl. Super easy to discern that. You don't have to be any kind of pulse diagnostician either. You just have to feel where their breath is going. This is not a metaphor for where the breath goes. This is just watching where the breath goes.
Yeah. And we see this with ourselves, with people. When we get congested, we take that big sigh. We release the diaphragm with a big breath. That is the movement of qi. And if we can recognize it there, we can see with our patients through our treatments, when by giving them the greater capacity for a full breath. I use REN 17 certainly for that. Where I see some of the great results that stick is through DO 9, by moving along the DO line. DO 9 in combination with UB 17, that area, particularly combining it with pericardium 6 and GB 40, seems to be a wonderful treatment for opening up that diaphragm and allowing the breath to fully move. And you take notice of this, there's no long points in here. This is about the congestion at the diaphragm. It's via a lot of times the Jiuyin.
Right. Has nothing to do with the lung.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the lung. No, absolutely not. This is our congestion in the pericardium and the diaphragm. Yeah. And then the second one that I think that we can always help people with is the dye. We get a lot of congestion at the dye, and I feel that quite a bit, the dye my. And it's another area that I think we have to take a little peek at, because we hold a lot of trauma and energy within the dye my that separates the middle burner from the lower burner, causing a tremendous amount of stasis. So those are the areas I feel like that with students, if we can just break up stagnation, we can see results happen. And then the tonification works better. And then the reduction helps better. And all the other treatments that we have greater capacity to flow and create new avenues for qi flow. It's available. It's kind of I don't want to call it a protocol, but it is a little bit of a available treatment that's a little bit low hanging, and we can just go for it, and it'll help everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, when I think about herbal medicine in particular, there's a very strong idea that before you do any kind of tonification, you want to make sure the stagnation is out of the way. Because if you tonify when there's stagnation, you're going to probably make the problem worse.
Yeah. Right. And we place so much emphasis on tonifying in the West. It's something everybody wants to get bigger, stronger, faster, smarter, prettier. And it's really something that we have to, we kind of teach that, because I've taught the herbal curriculum at AIMC, and we do kind of teach that you have to move along with tonification. But there's a reason why the category of harmonizing formulas is so helpful. We're Americans, we're well-fed. We sleep in safe homes more times than not. We are taken care of with our basic needs. Tonification is not always the way to go. It's about it's more about regulation and harmonization. That the harmonizing category is the category I draw from more than any other category in my practice. That and probably heat clearing, because a lot of people generate heat through their stagnation, right? All that friction from the stasis. So absolutely, the harmonizing category is one that we should become very familiar with as herbalists, because so many people can benefit from them. We don't always need to be tonified so much. There are times when we do, but it's not, as a whole, the most helpful source of treatments, I think, of benefit.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think so often people come to us and they've got the mindset of, oh, I'm using air quotes here, my immune system's weak. I need to strengthen that, right? They think something's wrong, or I need to strengthen, right? We're Americans because we're supposed to be strong. And if I can't do it, it must mean I need to strengthen. Likewise, because there are so many products being sold on the internet these days, a lot of people think they're toxic and they need to, again, air quotes, detox their system. And so often these are ways of selling products, and it kind of fits the American mindset. But indeed, I mean, when people come to me and they say, I need to detox, my first question usually is, are you pooping every day?
Yeah.
Do you have any trouble with your urination? No, I poop fine. I urinate okay. It's like, well, great. Guess what? You're detoxing. That's built into you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, so a lot of times it's about that regulation, because the system is more trustworthy than we usually give it credit for.
Yeah, right. And it's interesting that you went to the digestive area, as we all know that is a way to rid ourselves of waste products. But equally important is, of course, our sleep. And when we talk about confidence, and we talk about our mental well-being, and talk about seeing things as they are, not the way we think they are, if we don't get good sleep, we're so far behind the eight ball. It's incredible. And the more recent research around sleep, it's just becoming more clear is how damaging irregular sleep patterns are. And I'm as guilty as anybody else in terms of messing with my sleep. But we know I don't even know what percentage of patients come in who have sleep as if it's not the primary issue, it's right there at second or third.
Well, a lot of times people have sleep issues. They've had them so long, mm-hmm. they don't even think of it as an issue anymore. In fact, until we get into our interview, which tends to be, a little more comprehensive than you get in the conventional Western community, people, ask me, how's your sleep? It's okay. Okay in what way?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So you fall and stay asleep.
Right.
No. I wake up every night. How many times? 4 or 5. Oh, so you're not sleeping well. Huh. I guess I'm not. Right. I mean, it's out of so many people's awareness at this point.
Right. And so many of them, you ask them about their sleep, they say it's fine. And then you ask to further that topic and find out they're taking trazodone or they're taking some other sleep medication, which absolutely, it absolutely blunts the sleep cycles that are necessary for reparation. And I had a guy come in recently and we talked about, he was a young guy, about 32 years old. And he was talking about his sleep, said, yeah, I do actually really great with 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And, some of the recent research around that has shown that men who sleep around 5 hours, their testosterone levels just plummet, just absolutely plummet. And it can show up in fertility issues now, and it can show up as erectile dysfunction later. I have no problem telling them this information. You talk about a man's ability to have an erection and you get their attention real fast.
Yes, you do.
Right? So, and for women too, it's not just the impact that irregular sleep patterns has on not just our cognitive well-being, but our sexual well-being, and then not even our sexual well-being, but our immunity is tremendous. The hit that the natural T killer cells take from sleep deprivation, that is clearly been, sleep deprivation has been linked clearly to colon cancer, to prostate cancer, and other cancers, is becoming more and more clear with every new study that comes in. And so I'm really working on our patients about sleep. The brain opens up with sleep, meaning that it is that through the expansion of the plasticity of the brain, toxins are washed away from the brain. Our brain takes in about 20% of our caloric intake to function, which means it's producing somewhere around that in terms of waste product. And if we don't sleep, we are literally thinking with a toxic brain. That's that cloudy sense that we have if we start to function the day after a night of poor sleep. And certainly alcohol will compromise our delta wave sleep, and we feel that same thing. So people that are trying to cleanse themselves, or people that are trying to make profound progress in their well-being, if they're not sleeping, again, we're way behind the eight ball. It's the same thing as if they're eating, fast food every day. We have to get that stuff in order. And just alone, just by getting sleep and digestion in the right place, a lot of times our needles and our herbs are just complementary medicine to that part of the lifestyle adjustment, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and I love the way that you phrase this, that sleep is a kind of a detox. I mean, especially for people, at least here in America, we're here in America, so we're used to, treating the people that are here. Again, there's this whole idea that I've got a detox. Well, if we can link good sleep to the body's natural ability to detoxify, mm-hmm. I bet we get people's attention more with working on that.
Right. We get people's attention just by pointing out what they're doing in their lives and what the latest research says about how that is perpetuating pathologies. And it's, people have said now, that sitting is the new smoking. Right. And how the sedentary lifestyle, how incredibly damaging it is, and how it really increases risk factors for chronic degenerative diseases. And when we point some of that, the statistics and those studies out, it wakes people up real fast. I think that the part of my thing with building confidence with our students is we are primary health providers. We are holistic providers. We are sitting in a place where it is our responsibility not just to give the medicine, but also equally important, if not more important, to educate our patients on what in their life is not working for them. And maybe it works okay for them
now. Absolutely.
Yeah. And maybe it works for them okay right now, but when they start hitting 50, 60, 70 years old, it's a difference maker between aging rapidly or staying healthy and being able to do the things they want to do, like play with their grandkids and so on. So this is something that we take responsibility for in the role of healthcare providers, the role as Chinese medicine practitioners, that we just can't think about our medicine as how they're going to feel better today and tomorrow. We're really thinking in much bigger perspective than that. And it's our responsibility.
The educational piece that you're talking about here, I mean, it's so hard to get good information these days. I mean, you can watch TV and there's ads for drugs. That's not really information. That's a manipulation to get you to buy something. Skillfully applied, by the way. You go on the, internet to look for, air quotes here, information. Good luck with that, right? I mean, there's so many contradictory things, and so much of it is actually thinly disguised marketing for a product that someone's trying to sell you. So to help people make sense, to pull some signal out of all that noise, that's a really valuable service that we can offer.
Right. And we can't be too soft about it. I think that's one thing. We talk about confidence. We have to be confident in that information. We have to be confident in understand that we have to make this clear to our patients. Otherwise, we set ourselves up for failure. Our students, by the time they get through acupuncture college, they've got a pretty darn good sense from their teachers and from their experiences and their work that they've done on what it means to improve vitality, improve well-being, improve outcomes. They've got a pretty good sense. And we've got to be very willing to look our patients, that I square them up. And that's exactly what our patients want anyway. Anything less than that, that's not why they're there. They're not there for you to play softball. They're there because they want you to you know, throw the information at them that's going to help them get better, to call them on their
stuff. They want to be better. They have failed at getting better, and it's caught their attention, and now they're in our office because usually something else or several something else's haven't been so helpful.
Right. There's time to be soft and nurturing.
So they're looking for this stuff, right?
Yeah. There's times to be soft and nurturing and understanding and empathetic. And there's times to say, this is not acceptable for you. I'm a veteran and I go to the VA. And one of the best doctors I've ever had in my life was a VA doctor who asked me about my diet. And I told him, and he said, that's not working for you. You're eating far too much rice. Now I'm half Asian. I've been eating a lot of rice my whole entire life. And, he held out his hand and kind of cupped it. And he said, this is as much rice as you get. And he said, a handful of rice. Outside of that, your carbohydrate levels are intake is far too high, and you're going to mess yourself up. And it made sense. And he said it in a way that I'll spare you how brutal he was with it. But I learned
that. He got your attention.
I'll never forget that doctor. I'll never forget that visit. I'll never forget that talk. And so I've taken that experience with him. That was about 10 or 15 years ago now. I take that right into my patients and say, this is what you have to do. And if you can't make that shift, you're playing with an incomplete deck, because you're hurting yourself. It's a losing game. I think our patients want that. And I want to encourage the students and the new practitioners. And by the time a practitioner's been practicing for a few years, they figured out that they've got to do that. That you've got to be able to be very clear with our patients on what's working for them and what's not. Yeah, does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. There is a place to connect with our patients, and that's usually a soft place, And it's important that we do that in that moment to create a relationship. And then there's a moment where you can't pussyfoot around.
Yeah, right.
And I have had moments where I've had things come out of my mouth. And I've surprised myself a bit, because it's like, whoa, who just said that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it turns out it came from, because I did have a connection with the patient. It was kind of the voice of truth. I'm not saying it's because I'm smart and I like figured out what was going on, but sometimes when you are connected and in relationship, something will get said and it is spot on. It's uncomfortable as hell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really true. And when it's really true, that rings people's bell, and you'll feel it in the room when that comes out. Like you felt it with that doctor. When that arrives, it's like, whoa, there it is. You know truth when you hear it.
Yeah.
And people are, you know, when they hear that, you don't have to convince them, because they get it with their viscera.
Yeah, exactly. I got one more thing I do want to talk about, and because I wanted to bring up a few things that when you broached the subject with me about confidence. One other observation I've had over the years is that helps a lot of our students and new practitioners. Those students who become teaching assistants and work from as a third year student with a first year student, those people gain confidence really fast. They acknowledge what they're doing is that they're acknowledging what they know. They're acknowledging where they came from, and they're helping other people learn. And I know that for myself, when I help new practitioners, which I make myself pretty available to my former students, it's a confidence builder. And I know that for those students who are TAs, they gain confidence much more quickly than other students do. It just helping people builds confidence, whether it's as a practitioner or as a student helping other students. So I encourage people to share what they know, to give that information. I think students do that pretty well naturally, but in a more formal setting as a TA, that's a great place of power. Yeah, for their own self.
That makes so much sense. I mean, so often it's easy to see, oh, here's what I don't know. Here's where I'm not confident. Here's where I don't have it yet. Here's where, I mean, you can run that one for the rest of your life, the stuff you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking back to that wonderful mentor that you had who said, you know this piece already.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to worry about it. There's a piece that you know. To know what we know, is really important. And I suspect many of us overlook it. I know I do.
Yeah.
I'm happy we're having this conversation because it reminds me, oh yeah, there is a foundation. I don't want to get cocky about it and let my ego think it's all smart and intelligent. At the same time, I want my heart to be able to rest a little more comfortably.
Yeah.
Knowing that there are some things that it's not that I should forget about them, but I can just take some confidence and some rest in knowing there's a piece that's in place. I just need to keep it well oiled.
Yeah. I remember about 5 years after I practiced, I was in practice. One time I called Robert Levine to help me with an herbal formula. And he said, you know, Dennis, I got just the guy who I think can who has the answer for you. Because I don't know that I have the right answer for you. So he says, so let me give you his number. And he read off the number and it was my number.
Yeah.
And he said, Dennis, you trust yourself. You know this information. Go ahead and go for it. And that was very clever. He's a very clever guy and extremely helpful. And he knows when the fruit is ripe and it's time to just let it do its thing. So that was great. Yeah.
You got to know when the fruit is ripe.
Yeah, exactly. And we have to deal with our patients too. Sometimes we have to tell our patients, I would like you to put off making your next appointment and let yourself go out there and experience where you are right now. And if something comes up, by all means, give me a call in a month, give me a call in 6 months or a year. But let's just sort of see where you're at. Let's see how things have come to the fruition that we want them to come to, right?
Yeah, boy, that takes some confidence, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would like to circle back to one more thing.
Okay.
And it's something that you mentioned earlier. You said something about bearing witness to the voice of criticism.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear a little more about that.
Who's your biggest critic? It's yourself. We hold ourselves to such high standards. We notice if we're honest, we notice every single misfiring. We notice every single point of our own being, professionally, personally, all of that. And so we have to have that awareness and that honesty and be willing to go there and say, yeah, I kind of dropped the ball in this situation, or I gave it my best and it wasn't quite good enough. And all those things may be very, very true. And we have to really be clear on acknowledging our humanity or our humanness, right? And so with that, you know, we can celebrate our successes, but don't celebrate too long. And we should recognize our shortcomings, but don't dwell on those too long and continually learn. I hope that I'm not going to bore people to tears with this, but when the San Francisco 49ers won the Super Bowl for the first time, and back in the early 80s, I remember Joe Montana working the 49ers offense in the final seconds of the football game, trying to get a touchdown because they were four points behind in the game. And at one point in the drive downfield, he completes a 20-yard pass, and he just basically kind of trots up there for the next play without any emotional shift. And the very next play, he gets sacked for a 20-yard loss, and he gets up off the grass, and he's got the exact same look on his face in both plays. All he has is what's in front of him. He learns from that, and then eventually they get really close to a touchdown, and the team goes into a huddle. And at one point, the seconds are winding down to the final seconds of the game. They're still 4 points down, but the touchdown is right there in front of them. And at one point, he actually, from the huddle, pokes his head up above the huddle. And all the players are looking like, what are you doing? And he says to his players, hey, look, across the end zone, there's John Candy, the famous comedian. He was so present in the moment that the clarity of just the moment was all he wanted to be with and would deal with. And he noticed John Candy over there. And on the next play, he threw a touchdown that won the 49ers their first Super Bowl. And I think that kind of presence of mind and willingness to succeed and willingness to fumble the ball or fail are part of our practice. It's part of being professional. If you have a thin skin, it's going to be very difficult. And so that's kind of, I mean, is we have to be just very clear on witnessing the experience we're having in this moment. If I'm feeling really tense and I'm feeling really knotted up or I'm feeling really bummed out about something, just sit with it and pay attention to it. And by doing that, we create the fluidity, the emotional fluidity that gives rise to that emotional and professional resilience. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. And this is the first time in 20 years that I've heard a football story and metaphor used to explain Chinese medicine. And man, it totally makes sense.
Oh, Michael, take that one of my, within a 3-hour class, you'll get about 4 of those, I think. I have to apologize.
Football fan, are you?
Well, I think that there's a lot of lessons as somebody who coaches athletics. And I think that there's a lot of similar when we're talking about the intensity of chi in those situations. And by observing people when they're in, whether it's, it doesn't have to be football, it can be music, it can be art is just riddled with wonderful metaphors that apply to Chinese medicine. We're not talking about something so specialized like brain surgery. We're talking about something
but even in brain surgery, mm-hmm. are we thinking, or football or Chinese medicine, that ability to come back again to this moment, distracted, whatever, again to this moment, to be able to come back, mm-hmm. With what you got,
right,
and see what you got. And I love that story of he completes a 20-yard pass, no change in affect. Gets sacked for 20 yards, no change in affect. Just present.
That's walking the path between yin and yang. That's the way I see that. Not too excited, not getting down on yourself. That S line that is the center, the balance point of the Tai Chi. That's the path. That's the line we have to walk. 1 foot in the yin, 1 foot in the yang.
Well, that's what we began this conversation with, and mm-hmm. it's probably a good spot to end it.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you, Michael. This was fun.
Yeah. It was fun. Thanks, Dennis.
Yeah, absolutely, Michael.
Hey friends, as ever, thank you for listening to today's conversation. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed having it. Hey, I could use a little help with the podcast. If you'd like to help support it, I've got an ask for those of you that have a Facebook account. I would love it if on your Facebook feed, you would put a link to Chiological and make a note that this is especially helpful material for your Chinese medicine friends. If you got something and you love it, it's good to share it. So if you found some value here, I would appreciate if you take just a moment of time and link us up on Facebook, or actually link the podcast to your friends. Hey, thanks for listening, and tune in next week. I got more good stuff for you.